The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Lots to get to on today's program. We're going to be running through quite a few news items here in the first segment. But before that, just a quick update on the personal appearance campaign in Tampa, Florida. Last night, there were about 120 in attendance. And following the two-night event, we've got eight people. As it stands now, eight people signed up for the follow-up Bible study. I think my father, according to one of our other ministers on hand there, my father was really excited about the level of interest that he witnessed last night. So I would imagine he's back in Edmond, Oklahoma, and we move forward as always. We're still kind of a little worn out, some of us, from the busy weekend up in Belfast. In fact, we've got a segment, the second segment today, the Bible study portion. We're going to be playing an excerpt from the Sunday lecture that I gave in Belfast, Why First Fruits Are Called to Salvation Now. It comes out from Chapter 6 of Mystery of the Ages, The Purpose for the Church, or Why the Church. So we'll be playing that for the second half of the program. If you'd like to stay with us and peer into the Belfast pack, I talked a fair bit about it yesterday on the program, interviewing Edwin Trables, who manages our personal appearance campaigns here in the UK, and also on that program yesterday, just so that you know. In case you missed it, we had a nice three-minute montage with quite a few of the people who attended saying some really nice things about the church and the literature, the truth that they've received from this work. So if you didn't hear that, go back and listen to yesterday's podcast. As always, these programs are posted after the fact, after the live stream broadcast, at thetrumpet.com. website. Well, speaking of yesterday's show, I concluded the program with a few comments about the BuzzFeed smear on Friday and how the mainstream media just took it and they ran all the way to impeachment proceedings. I think some have said that the main networks or the cable news networks, I think the word impeachment was mentioned hundreds of times. And we played that montage for you yesterday, with the media saying, if it's true, and boy, they sure hoped it was true. If it's true, this means impeachment. They're just like a pack of hungry wolves, and their lone target is Donald Trump. The media are BuzzFeed. That's the thing. Ever since Donald Trump won the election in 2016, they have lowered their standard so far. The one standard is to get Donald Trump, no matter what. Doesn't have to be true. It can be fake news. It can be lies. It can be rumor, innuendo, any of that. As long as it will take down Donald Trump, that's the objective. Now, you think also, I think I heard one commentator on the right who just pointed to the timing of that BuzzFeed nonsense. Now that it happened just a day or two after we learned, and we discussed this with you last week, but a day or two after that we learned that the deep state knew all about the Steele dossier, how that it was a political hit job. Bruce Orr told them. He told the DOJ. He told the FBI. They knew. They knew that this was just political, a political hit job paid for by Hillary Clinton and the DNC. And yet they still waltzed right into court, FISA court, to get those search warrants or to be able to spy on the Donald Trump campaign. I think we learned about that on Wednesday last week, wasn't it? And then Friday, here comes another bombshell, which everyone was distracted with Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it says something when the bombshell is discredited by, of all people, Robert Mueller, who wants to take the president out. Well, I covered with you on the program yesterday toward the end why he came forward to denounce that story. He had to. But look at the media reaction. Just shameful through and through. And then through the weekend, you had this other story. I didn't even mention this yesterday. The Covington kids, these boys that were touring through Washington, D.C. And here, as we now know, all kinds of insults being hurled at these boys. Right and left, you had these Native American activists. You had these Black Hebrew nationals or nationalists, whatever they're called. Just insulting these Catholic boys, 17-year-olds. And the story all weekend was that the boys were the evildoers. They were the evildoers. One congresswoman tweeted out this: the students' display of blatant hate, disrespect, and intolerance is a signal of how common decency has decayed under this administration. Blatant hate, disrespect, and intolerance. And then, well, now we've all seen the full video. The full video that CNN didn't show. They just showed the little clip and then tried to say it means this. It means these white boys, these white teenage boys, are hateful. And they're just a product of the Trump age, says this congresswoman. Now we've seen the full video, and the story has changed. Even many conservatives that came out and criticized these, well, their own school apologized. The Catholic school had to apologize because the media mob frenzy got off and running. And the story was that these boys were the ones who were indecent and hateful and disrespectful. In fact, you look at the full video, and I would say that those boys, they exercised an extraordinary amount of self-restraint. And it was the Native American who came and got in the face of the 17-year-old kid. And it was those Black Hebrew nationalists who were hurling insults at those boys, calling them all school shooters, saying, you're going to end up going and shooting up a school. This was the statement that the 17-year-old released. He was wearing a Make America Great Again hat. That was his crime. He says, I'm being called every name in the book, including a racist, and I will not stand for this mob-like character assassination of my family's name. Listen to this. He says, I am mortified that so many people have come to believe something that did not happen. It did not happen. They weren't chanting, build the wall. They weren't doing anything like that. But here he is, a 17-year-old, facing all of these death threats and these threats of violence now because of CNN and other news organizations. And he says, I'm mortified that so many people have come to believe something that did not happen. Fake news. That's what it was. More fake news. Something that did not happen, that students in my school were chanting or acting in racist fashion toward African Americans or Native Americans. I did not do that. Do not have hateful feelings in my heart, and did not witness any of my classmates doing that. It's unbelievable what passes for news these days. And the media, they don't care if they destroy lives. They don't care if they destroy lives of young people. Let's just carry on and go after Donald Trump. That's the objective. No standards. Just take down the President of the United States. Listen to this report from MSNBC last night, clip one.
But we do now want to talk about another very important impact of the government shutdown. It is threatening a critical effort to understanding the effects of climate change.
What? The government shutdown is affecting the critical efforts to understand climate change? And who is to blame? Well, of course, that's Donald Trump. Here's what the guest had to say to that host you just heard, clip two.
Again, that will be critical to the future of life on Earth, this data, and the Trump administration shutdown has now put those flights in jeopardy.
The Trump administration shutdown, this is critical to life on Earth. We go from a partial government shutdown to climate change to Donald Trump threatening the life of every individual on Earth. I think it was Ocasio-Cortez yesterday who said that we're going to die in like 12 years because of climate change. It's insane what we're witnessing. These so-called experts that think they know better. They know what's right. The other side doesn't deserve a platform. They should be shouted down, or worse, you should go after them. How many was it that voted for Donald Trump? Into the 60 millions? 65 million, maybe? Here in the UK, you have this movement at the top tier of government to undermine the results of the election in 2016, the Brexit election. They're trying to kill it. The bureaucrats, the deep state, if you want to call it that, that's what it is. They're trying to kill Brexit. And there's a few in the conservative media saying, you better watch what's happening here. Here the British people voted for Brexit. Clearly, it wasn't even like it was razor thin. It wasn't an overwhelming majority by any means. But it was a comfortable victory in 2016. And since then, it's been, I think, 31 months, and it's turned into this battle between the people and the bureaucratic deep state. And you look around in the UK, of course, the vast majority of MPs in Parliament, they're against Brexit. The government, for the most part, is against Brexit. Certainly the Labour Party, from top to bottom, is against Brexit. The media, they're against Brexit. BBC is against Brexit. Same for the big banks and the companies. Same for the civil service, the non-political government actors or bureaucrats. They're against Brexit. It's just the people, the poor people, that are for it. They want to leave, but this deep, deep state, it views the people as angry or ignorant or even racist. So that's what we're seeing play out now. National Review last week, Theresa May, she's caught in the middle and pretending like she's this symbol of Brexit at any price, but National Review says in reality, she's a symbol of subordinating Brexit to the wishes of a Remain establishment and cabinet without seeming to do so. She's trying to pretend that, well, this is what the people wanted and this is what we'll deliver, but she's not delivering that. John Bercow, he's the easily recognizable Speaker of the House in Parliament. It's not like it's a powerful position that he has, but it is certainly visible. It's very visible, and he's there basically to serve as the referee in Parliament. He's there to ensure that the rules of Parliament are followed. And one of these rules is that only the government can put forward legislation. So the government gets to put forward something that it wants to be law, and then it's up to Parliament whether or not they'll approve it or whether or not it will go through. But Burko, like so many others around him, he's anti-Brexit. He doesn't want to leave. He wants to remain in the EU. And so he's declared that some of these House rules, they're not really rules. They're just more like guidelines. And you can break them if you have to, if it's really important. So he's there rewriting Britain's constitution because he knows better than all of the people that voted. And now you have this chaos. It's a chaotic scene, as I said last week, where all these MPs are trying to put forward all kinds of different bills designed to stop Brexit. It's not constitutional. But here again, the experts, they know better than the people. Pure and simple. The Telegraph said today, the problem is that the real intention behind these efforts isn't to increase oversight, but to stop Brexit. All these new laws they're trying to pass. It's not to give additional oversight. They're trying to stop Brexit. And that amounts to a coup, it says at the Telegraph. The preference is for a Brexit so soft that it's hardly Brexit at all. Melanie Phillips had a fair bit to say about it in that column I quoted from yesterday. She said, Brexit itself now faces its moment of greatest peril. Further on, this titanic fight, the fight between the bureaucrats and the people, it's now entered its final agony. If this battle for Britain is lost, she says, the repercussions for all who believe in political freedom, democracy, and moral integrity will spread far beyond its shores. That's in that column I went through yesterday. I made a bit of a different point with it yesterday, but here's where we stand in the UK right now. We've listened to this clip in our scrum meeting this morning. This is astounding, really. This is Question Time is a TV show on the BBC every, I think it runs every Thursday night. And in fact, Melanie Phillips is often on the panel of four or five speakers. And she's almost routinely shouted down by the others on the panel or booed by the audience. She's seen as an ultra-conservative. But here we are on Question Time, and they're discussing Brexit and how to leave, how to do it the right way. And as you would expect, there's only one person on the panel. There's only one person on the panel. I think there were six, including the moderator. And only one is for leaving. That's what we voted to do. And all the other panelists, they're anti-Brexit, including the moderator, the BBC moderator. And so the moderator here is talking to the one individual, the one lady that's there really speaking for the people. And I want you to listen to this exchange and then listen to what the audience does at the very end. This is clip three.
Is there any deal that can achieve a parliamentary majority, Isabel?
Well, the answer... Look, I can save everybody a lot of time here.
Because it's been 2 years, so
the short answer, the short answer is no, there isn't, and that is why it seems to me the only option for Theresa May now, and I'm going to admit that it is a suboptimal position, is to walk away. That is all she can do.
So to leave with no deal?
Yes, absolutely, because there isn't an alternative.
The audience, someone who supports that, because that was a massive cheer there.
That was a massive cheer, the moderator says. So if we can't get a deal, well, what should we do? Well, we leave. We leave with no deal. Brexit. It stands for exit. We leave. And the audience erupted in cheers. Yes, do it. That's what we want. That's what we voted for. And this moderator, seemingly shocked, well, when we come back, I want to hear from you, because that was a massive response. It sure was. Democracy. This is a title from yesterday. Is this the day democracy dies? Today may see an establishment coup in the corridors of Westminster designed to overturn the biggest vote in our electoral history. The biggest vote in our history. And the experts, the deep state, the bureaucrats, the parliamentarians, the leaders, they know better. They know better. And so they carry on with this. Undermining the will of the people, or in the case of what we've seen in the United States over the weekend, just trumpeting fake news. They dust off from BuzzFeed on Friday, and then Saturday and Sunday, they embarrass themselves all over again. It's like every day. They're out there manufacturing these crises, and meanwhile, the actual crises receive no coverage. The important stories are overlooked or ignored. Or if they are covered, they don't give the full story. Look at all the headlines from yesterday and today about the IDF, Israel, bombing Syria. These Iranian targets in Syria. Again, pointing to Israel as the aggressor. Israel was the one that bombed these Iranian targets. And Iran's response has been, well, we're going to obliterate Israel. And then you read 8, 9, 10, 11 paragraphs into the story and you learn the truth that says almost the opposite of what the headlines were saying. That it was Iran's Quds force that launched a rocket. This was from the outskirts of Damascus. They launched a rocket at the Golan Heights. That's in Israel. They launched a rocket at Israel on Sunday, and it was the Iron Dome that was activated. They had to shoot it down. The IDF tweeted a video of someone skiing at the resort, showing this rocket in the air and how the Iron Dome successfully intercepted it. And then, in retaliation to that, Israel launched these airstrikes against these Iranian targets in southern Syria. And then it was after those airstrikes that Iran released that statement that we're ready to confront the Zionist regime and eliminate it from the earth. But you rarely, if ever, get the full context of these kinds of clashes. The IDF spokesman, he talked about how that this was a premeditated attack from Iran on the Golan Heights. He said, this is a quote from the spokesman, that's a civilian site, and there were civilians there. We saw that as an unacceptable attack by Iranian troops, not proxies in Syria. These are just Iranians in Syria, firing rockets at Israel. And they think they have cover because, well, we're in Syria. And we know we'll get cover from the media. He says, in addition to that, the area from which the Iranians fired their missile is an area we have been promised that the Iranians would not be present in. We know it was not done in the spur of the moment. It was a premeditated attack. And so Israel responded and sent out a funny tweet together with it, a map of Syria with arrows pointing to this Iranian stronghold. This is where Iran is. And then they had a map of Iran and said, this is where Iran belongs. In other words, get out of Syria. You're right at our doorstep, firing a rocket into the Golan Heights. All of this misinformation, all of these manufactured crises that get all of the attention, and look at what's ignored. Today's the day you have France and Germany signing that deal, that treaty. In Aachen, of all places, Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, they're pledging a deeper economic unity, closer defense ties, a greater commitment to the EU, and they're signing it in the city of Aachen. The local says Aachen, which sits on the Dutch and Belgian borders, is rich in European symbolism as the seat of power of Charlemagne, the first century emperor who ruled over swaths of Western Europe. I don't know why they said the first. I guess the eighth. In any event, they're trying to resurrect the spirit of Charlemagne. Go back and listen to our program from Friday. The spirit of Napoleon. Here is Germany. Here is France. They're coming together. This treaty paves the way for them to develop a joint parliament, of all things. And they're looking to make EU reforms. Oh, yes. They're pledging closer military ties, even possible joint deployments. They're looking to cooperate more closely on the procurement of weapons. And then this jumped out at me, too. There's this mutual defense clause in the treaty that says, well, if you're attacked, we'll come to your defense, which isn't that interesting. Here they're both members of NATO. That's the NATO clause that takes care of that. If one member's attacked, all the other members come in defense of it. But it's as if they're already saying NATO is out the door. Here comes a new agreement, a mutual defense clause between France and Germany alone. These events are moving fast. These are the stories that are ignored or overlooked. Here's the real news. There was a story at Real Clear World about what happens when China takes over Taiwan. It talks about this shell, this defensive shell. China, it says, views Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines as one long wall, the Great Wall at Sea. And it mentions how that Taiwan, it's so mountainous that China can't see beyond it. It's right in its view. So they need, and then their navy has to go past Japan to get out into the ocean. So they need these locations. And that's why they've, since 2014, they've been building up these artificial islands in the South China Sea. They're trying to project their power, their influence, their range, their reach. And they want Taiwan. And they're going to get Taiwan before it's all over. There was a story last week that we didn't have time to get into. This Subic Bay base. It used to be an American base, and the Philippines said, well, we don't want you here anymore. This was 25, 30 years ago. So America left in 1992, I think it is. And just last week, we saw a story about these two Chinese firms, these two Chinese companies that want to buy that base, or what used to be the home of the U.S. 7th Fleet. America's 7th Fleet. If that fleet was there today, China wouldn't be building these artificial bases across the South China Sea. So they've got that. Eventually they'll get Taiwan. Now they're looking to move into the Philippines. These events are moving fast. There was a retired Filipino naval officer sounding the alarm about this base. This abandoned base. We can't just give it over to China. This is a security issue. But we'll be keeping our eyes on that. Because you look at how China is moving. China's on the march. You look at what Germany and France are doing. And all that we can be preoccupied with, it seems, are these manufactured crises. When we come back, we'll conclude today's program with an excerpt from the lecture that I gave on Sunday, Why First Fruits Are Called to Salvation Now. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Well, 16 years ago, this would have been March of 2003, we acquired the copyrights to Herbert Armstrong's literature, or most of it, all of the books, the correspondence course. That came after 6 years of litigation, and we had just started the college, Herbert W. Armstrong College, in 2001. So we started the college while we were in the midst of this litigation to obtain the works of Herbert Armstrong, and right after we won, the class that I happened to be teaching that year, Fundamentals of Theology, we were coming right up to the subject of why the church? What's the purpose for the church? And having just fought in court for Mystery of the Ages, I just was especially inspired going into that particular class, knowing that, of course, Mystery of the Ages has that masterful sixth chapter, Why the Church, or the Purpose for the Church. And having just fought for it, it just gave that, I think, that subject deeper meaning. The fact that we're not only here to spread the message of that sixth chapter and others, but we're here to fight for it. We're here to hold on to it as well. And this church made quite a few sacrifices to fight for Herbert Armstrong's literature. We stopped television for 2 years. We temporarily stopped our Philadelphia youth camp for 2 years because we were just immersed into fighting in court for Mystery of the Ages. And now you look back 16 years on and you think, as difficult as those years were, our youths were disappointed, obviously, that they couldn't go to camp for 2 summers in a row. But you look back and think it was well worth the fight so that we can make that literature available to all of you and many more today. Mr. Armstrong said in Mystery of the Ages, this is in the sixth chapter, "The real truth about the church, the reason for its origin and its purpose has remained hidden from even the professing Christian world." And I think quite a few of you understand that. They don't understand why the church. They don't understand the purpose for the church. There's lots and lots and lots of churches in the world, hundreds and hundreds of denominations, tens of thousands of church buildings, but precious few that understand why the church. Why should you come out of this world and into the church? And why are there so many people in the world who aren't in the church? What's the reason for this? What's the purpose that God's working out here below? Quite a few basic scriptures to get to today. Matthew 16 to begin with. If you brought a Bible, you're welcome to read along with me. Matthew 16 and verse 13. These are well-known verses. Mr. Armstrong, I think, discusses most of these verses that we'll read here today in that sixth chapter of Mystery of the Ages. Last night, we really tried to highlight Malachi's message, which in 1989 really had all of the answers for what was happening in God's church, this great falling away from the truth that's prophesied. 2 Thessalonians 2, Zechariah 3 and 4, Malachi 2, 3 and 4. All of that was prophesied. We've seen a lot happen in this seventh era of God's church. But God's work continues, just as Jesus said that it would. Here in Matthew 16, starting in verse 13, it says, "When Jesus came into the coast of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, 'Whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?' And they said, 'Some say that you are John the Baptist, some Elijah, and others Jeremiah.'" If you think last night what we were talking about, all of these specific prophecies. And Jesus asked his disciples, who do you think I am? And, well, some say this, some say that, some say Elijah. He says further on, he said to them, "But whom say you that I am?" And Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said unto him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed it unto you, but my Father, which is in heaven." God reveals it. He reveals the truth about the church. He revealed the truth about his Son. It says in verse 18, "And I say also unto you, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church," singular, "and the gates of hell," or the grave, "shall not prevail against it." So the church would continue, even though a little flock, scattered oftentimes, persecuted. But it would, as I said last night, it would continue through seven eras, right up until the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. God's work would never die. We talked some last night about God raising the ruins after all of that destruction following the death of Mr. Armstrong. Amos 9, verses 11 and 12. The work of raising the ruins. That's what this church is here to do. That's what you saw at the end of that short video. To raise up those ruins of old, his ruins, Mr. Armstrong's ruins, all that happened following his death, you know, even before he died. Some of you might remember, if you were associated with the Worldwide Church of God at all, even before he died, he was giving some blistering warnings to the church, telling us to wake up, saying, as you'll hear here in a moment, saying that most of you just aren't getting this message. You don't understand the purpose for the church. This clip that I'll have Richard in the back play for us, it's taken from his Pentecost sermon in June of 1985. This would have been 6 months before Mr. Armstrong's death. He's, I think, just turned 93 years of age. He can't see. He's blind. He just finished writing Mystery of the Ages in May of 1985. And this would be his last Pentecost message.
But why? Why the Feast of First Fruits? Why is this church the first fruits of God's harvest for his kingdom? Is God unfair? Is he discriminating against others to choose us first and they have to wait and come later? Brethren, I want to say to you, I think that most of you don't understand that at all. I think that most of you think that it merely means that God chose us to get into the kingdom first and then they'll come in later. That is not the answer at all. And I perceive that even our ministers, when they preach, take it for granted that we're just, the whole goal is to get us into the kingdom of God, and that's all we're called for now, and for no other purpose, but we'll get in ahead of the others. Then God is discriminating against the others. There is a reason why we're the first fruits. And I wish I could drive that home. But I fear that most of you just don't get it. You don't understand it at all. Why? Why are we the first fruits? I'm going to try to make it plain this afternoon, and still I think you won't get it. So much Protestantism has rubbed off on us, we can't get it out of our heads. They think God's trying to save the whole world, and then we think, well, he's just saving us first. And that is not the answer at all.
So you see there that he perceived that the church was going to sleep even then. He knew there was a big problem with the membership, even the ministers, as he said there. They didn't understand it at all. Why the church? Why should there be a time order? Christ, the first fruits, and then those that would come after. The truth about the first resurrection at Christ's return, the second resurrection at the end of the millennium. Of course, there's darkness in the world and all of the world's Christian churches. But as you can hear from that clip, darkness was setting in on God's people as well. Even God's people were going to sleep. That was at the peak of the worldwide church of God when he perceived that. Back when it was going all over the world, 380-some TV stations, 8.4 million subscribers to the Plain Truth, 120,000 members, hundreds of thousands of co-workers, millions of people impacted by that message, and yet those right within the church, they weren't getting it. They weren't getting it. Acts chapter 20, this is Paul, the Apostle Paul, on his return to Judea. And he stopped in a little place called Miletus, next to Ephesus, on his way back to Jerusalem. And he assembled the ministers from that region for a short, I guess you could say, a ministerial conference. And he wanted to really warn them and encourage them. He didn't know if he was going to be able to see them much again. Mr. Armstrong was 93 there in that clip. And he didn't know how much longer he would be around. So here's Paul toward the end of his ministry. And he's giving a very similar warning in Acts 20, verse 28. It says, "Take heed therefore unto yourselves and to all the flock over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers." He's talking again to ministers. "To feed the church of God, which he has purchased with his own blood." He wanted the ministers to get their minds off of themselves and onto feeding the flock of God. Feeding the lambs, feeding the sheep, as it says in John 21. That's the key, isn't it, when coming into the church as a member or a minister, is to concentrate and focus on the work of the church. The work of the church, which is, it's based on the principle of God's love, which flows out from self. God's love, as Mr. Armstrong often said, it's an unselfish, outflowing concern for others, for the whole world, ultimately. And Paul was pleading with these ministers. "You give to the flock," verse 29, it says, "For I know this, that after my departing shall grievous wolves enter in among you," you disciples, "not sparing the flock." Grievous wolves. See, as I said last night, we really shouldn't have been surprised by what happened to the Worldwide Church of God in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. This has happened before. Mr. Armstrong, he had one quote, if I remember, where he said, "Brethren, do we think that we're so superior to those members in the church from the first, second, and third century to think that we can't be deceived? To think that we won't fall away?" It happened in the first century. It certainly happened after Paul wrote this, or I guess Luke wrote it about Paul. It happened in our day. Verse 30 says, "Also of your own selves shall men arise, speaking perverse things, to draw away disciples after them." This is Paul telling his ministers, you don't get it.
You don't understand. There's grievous wolves are going to come right up from within the body of Christ and deceive many. It says in verse 31, therefore watch and remember that by the space of 3 years I ceased not to warn everyone night and day with tears. Don't forget the warnings. It's very similar what he said there in Acts 20. It's very similar to what Mr. Armstrong said repeatedly in the last 7 years of his ministry. You just heard an example of it. Another one from 1985, about the same time. He said, this is a final personal word. In a few days, I'll be 93 years of age. For some years now, there have been some, like vultures, waiting for me to die. They'd like to come back and take over the leadership of the church in my stead. I've been deeply concerned about this, but in no sense worried. This is the church of God, not of any man. Jesus Christ is the living head of this church. I am not. Now, as I said last night, following his death, God actually sent strong delusion to test us, to test our love for the truth. That's in 2 Thessalonians 2. It was a huge, massive test. And many of God's people have failed that test. They've just fallen away from the truth. They're drifting. Instead of standing fast, holding on to the truth, like 2 Thessalonians says, going back to this conference Paul had with his ministers, he says in verse 35, and this is a well-known verse, but you see the context now with what I've given you. It says, I've shown you in every way by laboring like this that you must support the weak and remember the words of the Lord Jesus, that he said it is more blessed to give than to receive. So when you come to events like this, and you can see it by the literature table, there's a lot of things that we just want to give to you. We don't charge for our literature. Jesus said, freely you have given, freely you've received, freely give. And so that's the principle we go by. And all the literature that we offer on the TV programs, that's offered free of charge as well. But obviously those things do cost money, and the TV time costs money. And that's supplied by faithful members and co-workers and donors, not just members, but co-workers, donors, readers of the Trumpet. And so they're making sacrifices so that we can give this message to a much larger audience. When you come in and you start obeying that principle of giving to others first, outflowing concern for others, God begins to bless you. You can't outgive God. If you just give, God will give so much back to you in return. I'm not just talking about a simple offering. I'm talking about a way of life. Giving of yourself in sacrifice to God's work. It says in verse 36, and when he had thus spoken, he kneeled down and prayed with them all. This is Paul praying with his ministers, and they all wept sore, and they fell upon Paul's neck, and they kissed him. Just imagine this scene, if you can. Paul giving this blistering warning, saying, when I'm gone, grievous wolves are going to come up and deceive a lot of you. And he says, okay, I'm about ready to go, and I may not get back here again. And they started sobbing. They started hugging him. They started kissing his neck. They were really going to miss Paul. And verse 38, Luke says, sorrowing most of all for the words which he spoke. Which words? They sorrowed most for these words which he spoke, that they should see his face no more. They were agonizing, they were sorrowing most over the fact that they wouldn't see Paul again, when they should have been sorrowing over the fact that grievous wolves were going to come in and devour the flock. Mr. Armstrong said, I'm deeply concerned about this, the vultures. But I know Christ is the head of the church. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. Mr. Armstrong, as I said last night, he's been dead for 33 years. But Christ isn't dead. Christ is alive. Christ is the head of the church. He's the head of the body. And when have you ever seen a body with one head and a jillion different bodies? There's one, there's many different members for sure, but there's just the one body. I'll read it to you in just a moment. 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4. There is no way you can get around that. There is no way you can read Matthew 16, as we just read earlier, and conclude, oh, I guess when he says I'm going to establish the church, he means 400 different denominations that all have different doctrines, different leaders, different teachings. It's one body, one head. Mr. Armstrong said in 1979, I sometimes wonder how many of you really comprehend what I have said so many times. God is not calling everybody to salvation yet. He says, have we not all, without realizing it, simply accepted the one most generally believed false teaching that God is now desperately trying to get everybody saved? He said he discerned in the 1980s that that was rubbing off on the church, that the whole idea here is that we're in this church, we're in this body to just get saved in advance of the others. And he would thunder, God's not calling the rest to salvation yet. So why are we here first? He would say to the church, are we God's favorites? No, not at all. There's a time order to this process. You look at the way the traditional Christian world views this plan of salvation, and they represent God as a weakling. He's losing out to the devil. All these souls are being lost, and God's helpless. He can't do anything about it. That's not the God that created this universe. When God sets out to save this world, he's already begun the process. He will save the world. And he's starting with just a few, training them, teaching them. Let me take you to another verse that Mr. Armstrong read a lot, John 6 and verse 44. If you've read Mr. Armstrong's writings, you know about this verse, John 6 and verse 44. The real problem with those ministers and with many in the church in the first century, and history repeated itself following Mr. Armstrong's death in 1986, is they just turned inward. They just became selfish. They just viewed the church more as, well, what can I get out of the church? Where can I find a church that makes me happy? Instead of thinking about, where is Christ and what can I do to give to and to support that church, that spiritual body, that spiritual organism? It's a big difference. One flows in towards self and the other flows away from self, out toward others. Last night I talked about that prophecy in Matthew 17 where it says that an end time Elijah would come and restore all things. And you know, one of the things that God restored to his church through Herbert Armstrong over the course of his 50-year ministry is that God is not now trying to save the world. Not now, not yet. That's coming, though. As soon as Christ returns and God's government is established on this earth, everyone on this earth, they're going to be hearing messages like this. All these people over here at the airport, everybody that you see, you pass on the road, the whole world, think of it. Think of it. Receiving God's truth. Becoming converted to God's way of life, that way of give. John 6 here in verse 44, it says, no man can come to me except the Father, which has sent me, draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. No man can come to Jesus Christ unless God the Father draws you out, unless God the Father opens your mind. God has to do something. You have to respond. You have a part in it too. But as Mr. Armstrong so often said, when people would convert to the truth, he said, now don't go and try to convert your relatives. God has to open their minds. And many have made the mistake of trying to do that. They've received the truth on that table over there, and then they go running to their relatives saying, look at what I found. Look at what I found. And they typically aren't received very well. Now, that said, a lot of people have come into the church because of a relative that just was letting their light shine, just setting an example, living the way of Christ, living the way of give. And then sometimes over years, I suppose, an uncle will say, well, you know what? I really want to look into that. He set such a wonderful example. Or a spouse, maybe, or a child. We do see that happen from time to time. But look at verse 45. It says, it is written in the prophets, and they shall be all taught of God. Every man, therefore, that has heard and has learned of the Father comes unto me. See, there is a time order, and eventually everyone's going to be taught. But in this age of the church, the church age, it's God who has to perform a miracle and draw you out of this world. And if you go all the way with Christ, into his church.